Hi, everybody. Welcome back. This is Mike Burstyn, and I'm very, very honored and happy to have a friend of mine join me today. I will give you a little bit on his background, and then we will schmooze. My friend is an American-born Israeli historian, author, politician, former ambassador to the United States, and former member of the Knesset for the Kulanu Party, and a former deputy minister in the prime minister's office. He is a veteran of the IDF, has taught at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, was a visiting professor at Harvard, Yale, and Georgetown universities. Wow, wow, wow. His published works include 6 Days of War, June 1967, Reunion, Power, Faith, and Fantasy, New Essays on Zionism, Ally, My Journey Across the American-Israeli Divide, and his latest, which is coming out when, Michael?
September 1st.
September 1st is entitled?
The Night Archer and Other Stories.
The Night Archer and Other Stories. And last but not least, and despite all of that, he's still my dear friend. Joining me from Tel Aviv, here is Ambassador Michael Oren. Hi, Michael.
What a thrill. What a thrill.
Hi, how are you?
We're okay. We're, you know, a little locked in, but okay.
Well, you know, we are talking now during the height of the coronavirus epidemic here in the United States and in Israel. I understand it's coming back.
Well, Israel opened up, and Israel is now completely opened up. The question is, did we open up too quickly?
Yeah.
And there's definitely a spike. We've now at a level of number of people who have tested positive, something similar to what we had in April, though fewer people are being hospitalized. There's a debate whether we're in the second wave or at the end of the first wave, but we're catching away.
And just to start out, how are you coping, and how is it, has it affected your, obviously, your daily activities, your daily work? How are you coping?
Sure. It's interesting. I come from a small town in New Jersey, West Orange, New Jersey, for you West Orange fans out there. And West Orange is known not for being the hometown of the former Israeli ambassador to the United States. It's known as being the hometown of Scott Kelly, who was the longest American ambassador, spent the longest amount of time in outer space. He went to my elementary school. They actually have renamed my elementary school for him, for the Kelly brothers. And I was very much influenced by an interview that Scott Kelly gave at the outset of the COVID crisis, where he said the way you maintain your sanity in isolation in outer space for an entire year is by making a schedule and keeping to the schedule. Because actually, the hardest thing for him coming back to Earth after that was getting out of his schedule. He was so much into it. So I got a schedule. So I get up in the morning. I write. Either write, you know, fiction, nonfiction. And then if it's nice outside, you know, maybe I can go for a run. It depends on how much of a lockdown it is. I play guitar. My wonderful wife, Leslie, and I play chess for an hour or two. She usually beats me handily and has great fun taking my queen every time. And I study French and I study guitar. And I have to report that my French speaking, my guitar playing are not, I would say, my strong points, but I'm doing them. And again, exercise is absolutely crucial. At least an hour of intense exercise per day.
Wow. That's amazing, because I think the most frustrating thing for most people is the lack of a schedule. I mean, when you don't have, you get up in the morning and you look at your calendar and there's nothing on it, that's the problem. What do you do?
Same thing. I find out I actually don't have enough time during the course of the day.
Wow.
I think, what did I do before I was locked down? How's that possible?
Wow.
Amazing.
What about rowing? I know that you, is it the skull? What is it?
I have a skull, yeah. Well, if there's no lockdown, the boat clubs are open. I row. I have a skull that I brought
right
from Asia, and I row it on the mighty Yarkon River. Which has not one but three boathouses on it. It's a nice little river. It's kind of straight. It's kind of quiet. It's gotten a lot cleaner. And this morning I rode about 14 kilometers.
I've seen you on the mighty Yarkon. Yeah. I want people to know how we first met, and it's a fascinating story. It was several years ago. I was on the phone with our mutual friend Ido Aharoni, who was the consul general in New York at the time. Mm-hmm. And let's see if you remember. And he said to me, "I have someone that's sitting here with me, and he was like to say something to you." And you got on the phone. And you remember what you said?
I said, "It's all your fault," because many years before that, when I was a 15-year-old kid and coming to Israel for the first time to kibbutz Gan Shmuel, I arrived in the middle of a burning hot July day, right? I come down off the bus, and all these kibbutzniks are waiting for me. They're waiting for me. I figured, wow, this is something. They're having this reception. I must be very, very special indeed. And then I found out why everyone was waiting for me. My name before it was Oren was Bornstein. Okay, so they heard that Mike Bornstein was coming to the kibbutz, and so they. Disappointment when they found out that I wasn't Mike Bornstein. But I think I accused you of having to live your life, having to go in your footsteps wherever I went for the next 30 years.
And you, I think they called you Kuni Lemo?
They called me Kuni Lemo, sure. But it's everywhere it's Mike Bornstein, everywhere I go. I had no idea who this person was, by the way. I never saw Kuni Lemo.
Well, you know now. Well, for those of you who don't know Kuni Lemo is a film that I made. Then we did two sequels, Kuni Lemo in Tel Aviv, Kuni Lemo in Cairo. And it's about a Hasidic character, a funny character. And everybody in Israel since that film came out, oh boy, 1966, quite a while ago, they still consider me Kuni Lemo. It's, you know, third, fourth generation. I've been Kuni Lemo ever since. Just wanted to talk a little bit about, you were mentioning you're born in Jersey, a little bit about your upbringing before you came to Israel. Was it a traditional Jewish home that you grew up in?
Not very. We were on the reform side of conservative, and didn't keep kosher, didn't keep the Shabbat, went to shul twice a year and drove there on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah type of thing, but culturally very Jewish. By contrast, though, I was the only Jewish kid in my neighborhood, mostly Sicilian neighborhood, got beaten up pretty regularly for being a Jew. My father, who's 95 years old, I speak to him every night, landed on Normandy with his brother and fought World War II. His brother actually liberated a concentration camp, took a lot of photographs of the concentration camp. And every time I'd come beat up home, from the anti-Semites, my father would show me these pictures and say, you see that, son, that's why we need a strong Israel. That had a big impact on me. And growing up during the period of the Six-Day War, where we thought that Israel was going to be destroyed, and we woke up on that seventh day and Israel wasn't destroyed, big impact on me. So at a very early age, I decided, I'm not going to miss the most exciting story in the last at least 2,000 years of Jewish history. I'm not going to spend it in New Jersey. So as soon as I could, when I was 15, I went off to kibbutz. And then like a nutcase, every year I'd come back from kibbutz, I would shovel snow and rake leaves and mow lawns and save up enough money to go back to Israel every summer and work for free.
And at what point did you decide to make the move?
I had decided as a kid that I was going to move to Israel. The question was when. There was the issue whether I would do the Army first or University first. I ended up doing University first and then coming into the Army. But I always assumed that I was going to live here.
Before I forget, I want to mention something that you helped me tremendously with. Speaking of the Six-Day War, in 2017, we were about to commemorate the 50th commemoration of the war, which I was in. I took part in it. And I had been holding on to a story all those years that someday I said I have to turn into a motion picture, a film. It was a story about two soldiers, an Egyptian and an Israeli, who meet at the end of the war in the Sinai Desert. And luckily, I was able to write the script, get the funding for it, and we decided to shoot it early 2017. And there was one problem I had, if you remember, that the action takes place in an abandoned building in the middle of the desert, a two-story building, and we couldn't find one. Obviously, we couldn't shoot it in Sinai, so we were looking for an area in the south of Beersheba, and we found this building, an abandoned building. It was an old army building, and I had to decide, what is this building doing in the middle of the desert? And I called you, and I said, can you help me? Because this building is integral to the story of the film. What could this building be doing in the middle of the desert? And remember what you came up with.
I came up with that it should be a building belonging to the United Nations Emergency Force.
Exactly.
That had picked up and moved out of Sinai at NASA's order. So it would be an abandoned building.
So you basically were my art decorator for my film. And I think I should give you more credit in the final credit of the film. The film was
great. Really,
yeah, thank you. But that was really tremendously helpful. Tell me what's going on right now. You know, we don't want to get into politics, but it seems.
Why not?
No. Well,
everyone else does.
Manishtana halayla hazeh. What is this different than all others? How do you see the future? What's going to happen? Are we going to continue in this cycle, or is there a way out?
A cycle of what? Is it the cycle, a political cycle? Is it the cycle with the Palestinians? Is it the cycle with the Iranians? We're in multiple cycles here. Take your pick. I can answer any one of them.
Well, let's start with a cycle of peace. Is there any hope, you know, for some kind of cooperation? And let's say we have to make some compromise so that my kids, your kids, your grandkids wouldn't have to go through this over and over and over again.
Depends how you define peace, and depends how you define what, you know, it sounds vaguely Clintonian, but depends how you define what this is. I come from a different perspective, Mike. I've been involved in this peace process almost from its inception. I was an advisor to Yitzhak Rabin back in the 1990s during the period of Oslo. I've seen peace initiatives come and go, come and die, one after another. I participated in the last round of discussions with the Palestinians, now over 10 years ago. They lasted 6 hours, by the way. So I've come along with a couple of basic assumptions. One is that the Palestinians don't have yes in their vocabulary. It goes back to the 1930s. They hold the world's record for the people that has turned down a two-state solution most frequently, and they usually turn it down with violence. So if you have a peace process that's going to be predicated or conditioned on Palestinian agreement, it's going to be doomed in advance. And when I was in Knesset working with the prime minister, I would consult with the White House, with the people who were working on what became the peace plan. And I told them this. I said, don't aim it at the Palestinians, aim it at the Sunni Arab states, and aim it at the Israeli center. If you sell something to the Israeli center, it would be very important, because the Israeli right wing, much more than the Israeli left wing, is going to oppose it, because it involves concessions, and it involves some type of two-state solution. And I think they internalized this advice. And that's the peace plan we're dealing with now. Palestinians have said no. The question is whether the Sunni Arab states, Saudis, the Emiratis, the Omanis, Bahrainis, can come along and make a deal with Israel that would greatly benefit the Palestinians, give them a political horizon, give them $50 billion in development aid, and lay the groundwork for what could be later. You know, we don't actually have peace now. We'd like to have peace now, but we don't. What could be later, a more stable form of coexistence.
Wow.
Yeah, there's that cycle.
So that's it, right? That's all we need to do.
Well, there are many other things we have to do too. This is the Israeli right, is very, the extreme right is very influential. They're against any form of Palestinian state, even a Palestinian state that's basically just an autonomous entity, where Israel maintains the security over Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, including the airspace. That state has, doesn't have ability to make treaties with foreign entities like Tehran, for example, and you know, has a very small military force, basically an augmented police force. I could live with that. I think that's a manageable situation. But the very right wing in this country rejects any form of Palestinian statehood, and the Palestinians themselves are rejection. So that leaves the Israeli government, this very wide Israeli government. I don't know how stable it is. I don't know what its longevity is. But one of the cornerstones of the coalition is accepting of the peace plan and an attempt to move it forward vis-a-vis these Sunni Arab states, which have so much to gain, Mike, from peace. The wedding of Arab resources with Israeli technology, the ability to stand together as allies against Iran, a tremendous amount at stake here if we can just move this ball forward. You can't live in this country without being an optimist.
Yeah,
look at the great swath of Jewish history without being an optimist.
Well, was it Ben-Gurion who said that Israelis are optimists who believe in miracles? Was it something like that?
Or pessimists who believe in miracles. Yeah. But no, you just can't. You can't. I've been here for 41 years. It's kind of scary to say that. See what Israel was like when I came here and what it's like today. And you got to be an optimist. To live through the, you know, the Aliyah of Ethiopian Jewry, the freedom for Soviet Jews, to see our relationship with the world today. Who would have thought when, you know, we were young, we thought that they would have relations with China and relations with Vietnam and relations with all these countries. There's no Arab boycott today. So it's really quite miraculous. You gotta believe in that. But so even facing the peace process and all the difficulties there, I think this particular peace plan is the most realistic I've seen. And I've seen them all. It's the only one that really reflects what is possible in the field to do. And I hope that our government will navigate prudently, intelligently in order to advance this process.
Well, as we say in Turkish, "Finden moyl zu Gott's Ohren," which means from your mouth to God's ears. Let's switch a little bit and talk to me a little bit about your new novel.
Ah, it's a novel. It's a collection of short stories.
Oh, sorry.
Into 53 short stories. There's a novel coming out early in 2021. These are short stories that I started writing when I was in politics, because in Israeli politics, and by the way, in parts of Israeli American politics as well, you cannot be in office and publish a book. The assumption is that you're going to exploit your exalted position as a member of Knesset to advance book sales. But that doesn't mean I still got up every morning and I wrote. And I wrote these short stories. This is represents my 4 years' work on short stories. They are, what can I say? They are different. They are historical. They are love stories. They are crime stories. They are science fiction stories. Told from many different perspectives. One of my favorite stories takes place on the in a remote frontier outpost in 1841 in the Rocky Mountains. Dante takes in Israel. There are a couple of them related to the Holocaust. There's a story called The Night Archer about a person who suffers from insomnia and falls asleep by imagining an archer. I can't self-aggrandize here, but I want to be able to guarantee that if I pick this up, we'll enjoy it.
And when is it being published?
September 1st. And now we come up to the question is, how in the age of Corona do you sell a book? Because in the old days, you got on an airplane and then you went on tour.
Right.
You can't do it anymore. So we're in the brave new world of podcasts, radio, social media. There are actually now companies that do Zoom book tours.
And, right. Like what we're doing now.
A Zoom book tour.
Well, Amazon, obviously.
As they say here, zoom golly golly. You got that.
Zoom golly golly. Tell me, if I asked you one person that was your inspiration when you were young, when you were growing up, that inspired your life. Can you think of that one person that may have been your inspiration?
Oh, it's Yitzhak Rabin. When I was 15, I joined the Zionist youth movement, and like all good Zionist youth movements, the first field trip we did was to Washington, D.C. And we had in the basement of this rundown hotel, we had a meeting with Israel's ambassador to the United States. Now, this was in the years right after the Six-Day War, where Yitzhak Rabin was, God was second to Yitzhak Rabin.
Yeah.
And I got to shake his hand. And at that moment, I said, okay, that's what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be Israel's ambassador to the United States.
How old were you?
15.
15.
And I tell you honestly, I designed all of my sort of career moves, my education, in order to achieve that goal. So I went to study history. I went to study Arab history and Arabic and Hebrew. And interesting, for a writer, I didn't study English literature. I think I've never taken an English literature course. And then I got to work for him as a lowly advisor, but I used to see him every day until the horrible day in November of 1995 when he was assassinated. He had that inspiration. One of the hardest things I had to do, I wrote this book about the Six-Day War, it's called 6 Days of War. And Rabin, of course, figures in this book. And what I learned going through the archives and documents that hadn't been declassified, I was the first one to read them, was that Yitzhak Rabin really didn't take part in the war. He had a nervous breakdown a couple of days before.
Right.
And we didn't know this growing up. He was the hero. He was marching under the Lion's Gate, going to the newly liberated Western Wall, the Kotel. So we didn't know this. And so for me to actually write that story about Yitzhak Rabin was very difficult.
We're kind of coming to the end of our little schmooze here.
Oh, we can go on for hours, you and me.
I know. Well, we'll do more. We'll do another one. But what about your future goals? I know, I always try and find something new to do, and not repeat and just tread water. I always look for a new goal to reach. Any goals that you haven't?
Plenty.
And what you'd like to do that you haven't done yet?
Besides putting together a decent sentence in French.
Tu parles, bonjour, monsieur. La plume de ma tante est dans le bureau de mon oncle.
Tant pis. Anyway, after the publication of The Night Archer, my novel is going to come out hopefully in January. It's called To All Who Call in Truth. And I know you're going to like it. And it's a bit of a mystery romance set in the suburban town, but it's interesting. And I have other writing projects. I'm now preparing to write my next big history book. It's about one day, which I think is the most transformative day in modern history. It's May 14th, 1948, called Creation. May 14th, 1948, the day of Israel's creation. That'll be about a 400-500 page book. My books take about 4 years to write, history books. They're very serious. In addition, I've written a what I call the manifesto, which is something I've wanted to write for a very long time. It's called Israel 2048, the rejuvenated state. And it is 40 years of my experience in government, in the military, in diplomacy, to put together a vision of what Israel should look like on its 100th birthday. And the vision, which it comes about, will enable Israel to survive and thrive for another 100 years. So I've now written this, and we're beginning discussion groups around the vision, and I invite people to look at it and to tear it apart, whatever. But the important thing is that we have the discussion, because nobody's really talking about the future here. Everyone's so consumed with what's going on right now without having long-term thinking. That's what this is designed to do. And it's very exciting to embark on that project. Other than that, I'd really like to beat Leslie in chess occasionally. Please let me keep my queen for more than 10 minutes. it would be nice. And I'd like to go visit my parents in West Orange, New Jersey. I can't visit them.
Well, in 2048, I will be 103.
You will be going nonstop. I know you.
So, but you'll be much younger. I mean, gosh, you're much, much younger. So we can still meet and continue this discussion in 2048. Do you agree?
In hologram, yes, I'm sure.
Michael, thank you so much. It's been such a joy. We'll do it again. I want to thank you for spending this time with me and being my friend. We love you.
Love
to both of you from both of us. And thank you, folks, for joining us. And remember my motto, it's very important, carpe diem, seize the day. And shalom.
Shalom.